But first to some of the fun being inserted into campaign slogans for one of the most remarkable elections ever held in our region, which is totally captivating the citizens of Jakarta. And that little bit of audio was recorded in Perth, a flash mob singing dancing sequence in support of a man we're about to talk about now. Who would have thought that a local government election in Jakarta could produce this level of passion? So Indonesian diasporas around the world are joining in. If you go to YouTube, you can see all the shots. Building to a climax this coming Wednesday, when the election's held for the role of Governor of Jakarta, Indonesia's sprawling, chaotic capital, in which Basuki Jahaja Purnama, known as Ahok, is up against two other much more orthodox candidates, including the son of former President SBY. So why is Ahok unorthodox? Because he's both Chinese and Christian. And if elected, as opposed to appointed as he is now, he'll be the first Christian to occupy this role in a Muslim-majority city. Plus, he's on blasphemy charges as part of a big pushback by fundamentalist Muslim groups. It has everything, this election. The biggest event ever in Jakarta, some quite sober analysts say. And as we'll hear, representing a great deal for the wider nation. Joining me to wade through this is Tobias Basuki from Politics and International Relations at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Jakarta. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks, Sheridan, for having me.
So what is the mood in Jakarta? I hear it's really ramped up.
Yes, I think it's a very exciting mood for both good and bad reasons, but I think at this point, mainly for good reasons, I think people in Jakarta and also, as you've described before, the diaspora are very excited about the election. We also hear reports of people actually coming in from Australia, from Singapore to Jakarta to actually be part of the election. So it's a very interesting time.
I have heard exactly that myself. I heard of two people flying back so they could cast a vote.
Yeah.
Because they see it as a great deal at stake. As one man said it, I think the whole 20 years of progress could be put at risk if he doesn't win. Now, do you agree with that or not?
Yes, I think it may sound like a hyperbole, but I think it's not really so much of an exaggeration. I think that's very accurate for at least two simple counts. One is the so-called brouhaha surrounding this Jakarta election is not really a matter of religion and politics in reality, but it's actually an attack against clean, transparent government, because this is also, like as other observers said, bigger than Ahok. So that's one. And the second point is this is very important because it also will determine the trajectory of Indonesian political climate in the future. If Ahok were not to win, politicians and political parties will learn that primordial issues are effective to actually take down an opponent. And all other parties will learn from this and will continually use black campaigns, ethnic and religious issues.
But you yourself, I think, looked at the role of religion in previous big general elections in Indonesia, in this very important emerging democracy, and you said that it hadn't played a big role in the past. Are you changing your mind in this gubernatorial election?
Very interesting. Yes, as we've seen actually in the last presidential election, religion and ethnicity in whatever form does matter, but it does not make or break an election. So that's what I'm convinced of. And I would say the Indonesian so-called fabric, culture, and history actually counters very much what we see in primordial politics in other places. We have, I think you mentioned, Ahok will be the first Christian governor elected, but yes, for Jakarta, but in other regions, we have actually Christian governors in majority Muslim regions at the district and vice versa. So that's not something completely new for Indonesians. But at this point, a lot of political players and Islamist groups are narrating along that line. So I'm still confident of the Indonesian people, but of course, this coming election will be the litmus test whether in a way my assumption is proven right or wrong on the fabric, on the basic grassroots sentiment of the people. But I think that will not make or break an election.
And what do you think he will win? At the moment, he's ahead, and a couple of pollsters say he's ahead on about 36%. In fact, his vote has risen, notional vote has risen, because he's done very well in the two panel debates, I gather, and there's another one on Saturday night. And the other two main opponents are down in about the sort of mid-20s. Do you think he'll reach a 50%, in which case there wouldn't be another election, or do you think there'll be a runoff elections?
The conventional wisdom of the day now from many observers is it's going to be a very tight election. It's going to be, no one actually believes that Ahok can win within one round, and if it goes to the second round, it's going to get very tough. And I agree, if it goes to the second round, it's going to get very ugly.
Oh, really?
Yes. Because both opponents will, at this point, are attacking each other to make sure they're the runner-up. So that's why it's not ugly yet. But once there's two candidates against, basically one candidate against Ahok, everyone will unleash their primordial issues. But having said that, I probably maybe am a bit naive, but I have a sense, it's just a hunch. I think it's not, I would not be entirely surprised if Ahok wins within one round.
Oh, interesting. And the whole climate around Mohammad Razik, who is from the FPI, which is the Islamic Defenders Group, who've really been so very, very noisy and changed the politics and brought the charges effectively again of blasphemy. He's got himself into all sorts of problems, hasn't he? And that's changed things.
Yes. Well, he's got into all sorts of problems for the wrong reasons. But I'll just be frank, he is just a mercenary for hire. His group is a group of thugs. But by some accident of history and convergence of interest, he, in the past 2 months, became the symbol of a new type of political Islam, which doesn't really represent Indonesia's political Islam. But yes, he is now in hot waters.
Tell us why.
Because I think he represents actually the interests of behind this movement, who are actually attacking clean government, which is the Jokowi government, not just Ahok.
He's up on pornography charges, and yes. Also that he Christians countersued, as it were, and said he had blasphemed against Christianity.
Yes, here's the thing: why it's so complex, because he actually is guilty of all the right things. He's guilty of hate speech. He's guilty of what they're called threatening to kill, Ahok and other things. But we don't even have a hate speech law. That's why it's a bit ridiculous at this point in the Indonesian legal framework. Mm. On the other hand, we have all the what they're called ludicrous laws, like the blasphemy law, which protects ideas and beliefs which cannot be protected. And that's why the government and other groups are using that against Razik. So it's like Razik and his group are playing by punching below the belt, and now everyone else is playing by that. Rules of the game, punching below the belt.
Okay, well, look, good luck. It's obviously a pretty extraordinary old set of circumstances in Indonesia, in Jakarta in particular, which is this giant conurbation that determines so much in Indonesian life. I hope you enjoy it, if that's the right word.
It'll be a very exciting election.
Tobias Basuki from the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Indonesia. Well, let's broaden things out now to discuss our relations with Indonesia, how and why they might be changing. And as, of course, we now know, this vital visit by President Joko Widodo has now been rescheduled for February the 26th. It's always been a contentious relationship with our neighbour to the north, and perhaps we can take some comfort in knowing that Indonesia has strained relations with many of its neighbours, Malaysia and Singapore, for instance. But are we even relevant into their geopolitical sense of what matters? Joining me to discuss this is Tim Lindsay, Professor and Director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society at the Melbourne Law School, who says we may have to learn a good dose of realpolitik in the future. Welcome back, Tim.
Thanks, Geraldine.
You say something is shifting in our relations with Indonesia, where we might now be seen as a junior partner by them in our bilateral relationship. Why so?
I think that there's not much question that that is the case in Jakarta, rightly or wrongly, and there's no point arguing whether it's justified or not. I think there has certainly been a shift in recent years, and I think it even started before Joko Widodo, whereby Australia is seen as a country of relatively less importance than Indonesia in the world in Indonesian eyes. put simply, they say that we matter a lot less to them than they do to us.
And you've been hearing this at various levels, have you?
Oh, yeah, for some time. I mean, people who are well-disposed towards Australia and supporters of Australia and Indonesia, even they would ask why Indonesia should particularly care about what Australia thinks on any given issue. Why do we matter? And they say that when an issue comes up, Australia needs to explain why its opinion should be given weight. Now, I don't want to overstate this. In the bilateral relationship is a working relationship, and at times it's very amicable, at other times it's strained, and that relationship will always be something that both countries work on. But the shift has occurred whereby, I'll put it this way, and I'll cause great offence to all your listeners from New Zealand, but I was told by a influential opinion maker in the Indonesian government recently that Australia is to Indonesia as New Zealand is to Australia. Now, the population differences give a sort of sense of this. And what's really changed is not so much anything specific in terms of either country, except that Indonesia sees itself now as a rising power. And
well, it's been told that, hasn't it, by all various agencies?
All the rating agencies say, rightly or wrongly, again, I don't express a view on this, but this is what is said and this is what is repeated by leaders in Indonesia, that Indonesia will be in the top 10 economies by 2030, bigger than Germany, for example, and in the top 5 in the world by 2050. And that will, if it's true, entirely transform our region. We'll see the sort of shift in power and economic clout and influence that occurred in a wider scale in Asia with China's rise in a very short period, again in Southeast Asia. So Indonesia, which is in population terms overwhelmingly the giant of Southeast Asia, the most powerful country in ASEAN, sees that it will be a major world player sometime in the next 30 years or so. Mm. And that's changing the way it sees us, because obviously we're not going to be in that position. Australia isn't rising.
Well, we're a middle power, and of course, in many respects, that's exactly where they are, but they clearly see themselves moving out of that.
That's correct, and despite their best efforts, their economic growth sits around 5%. We're not going to achieve that, and I think the rating agencies just draw a line assuming that that sort of growth will continue, and it does seem to be pretty solid growth considering that the mess that its economic policy is in most of the time. It's great difficulty in actually implementing any policy changes. And so if that's true, well, they're probably right that they will become a much more significant force in the region than we will. Mm. And that does change the way they're treating us, and we will have to just adjust to it.
Well, how do we adjust to it?
We'll have to shift the way we deal with this relationship. There's a few lessons we have to learn from recent tensions. The first is there are always going to be difficulties in our bilateral relationship. They are close neighbours. Indonesia has never managed its relations with close neighbours well, as you said earlier. Malaysia and Singapore have just as many difficulties as we do. So there will be tensions. They're inevitable. And we shouldn't panic when they occur. We need to be patient and wait. Often these difficulties arise because of the chaotic and undisciplined way in which policy is made in Jakarta. Senior officials making statements on the run, often poorly considered. Internal elite fights over who will fix policy and set it, as we saw in the recent tensions over the military relationship.
Yes, and look, it's interesting. I noticed that General Wiranto, who is the Minister for Internal Security, with, of course, quite a lot of history that Australians know about, he actually came out this week and made a very interesting remark, I thought, Tim, that he said, look, I think things have been patched up effectively. We've dealt with it like family. It was quite a statement about Australia and Indonesia, I thought. Did that hit you?
He also said that the issue was just a little incident. I think that's a typical example of how these problems are sorted out in Indonesia. We have to give time for the elite to have their squabbles and sort out their position. We need to not turn these things into controversies that we run in parliamentary debate or in our media. We will have differences from time to time, and some of them will not be resolvable easily because they're fundamental differences of values over issues such as capital punishment, for example. And other matters, we will be able to reach compromise. And we probably need to work harder at repairing the relationships than Indonesia does. Rightly or wrongly, I think they're correct that Indonesia's importance for our strategy, our defence strategy, for example, it's really our shield to the north, its rise in the economic power, the fact that it mediates our position in a whole range of regional fora, mean that we have to manage the relationship, whereas they don't particularly need to. So in the years ahead, keeping the bilateral relationship with Indonesia stable for our own benefit will mean we'll probably have to work harder to keep things nice than Indonesia will. And, you know, that's not necessarily right or fair, but I think it's just the way it is, and we'll just have to accept that.
Dose of realism entering our veins. Look, thank you very much indeed, Tim Lindsay, for that overview.
Thanks, Geordie.
And Tim is Professor and Director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society at the Melbourne Law School, and, of course, quite a welcome guest on this show throughout a year.